Hi, welcome to Dr. Fred Bell's Health, Science, and Energy Show. October 10th, 2008. Tonight, our guest is Dr. Michael Brooks, who wrote this fantastic book published at Doubleday called 13 Things That Don't Make Sense. And I know a lot of things don't make sense, but these are 13 things that are very much don't make sense. Being a homeopath myself, I've never been able to figure it out. That's one of the things we'll discuss. Michael Brooks is a PhD, is formerly a senior editor and now consultant for the New Scientist, in which the widely popular article on which this book is based first appeared. His writing has appeared in The Guardian, The Independent, and The Observer, and he's doing this show from England. Hi, Michael. How are you doing, man?
I'm doing very well. Thank you.
Oh, yeah. You're nice and loud now. I can hear you really well.
Okay, good.
So it's nighttime over there.
It's early evening, yeah.
Is it hot like it is over here in California?
Oh, no, I wish it was. It's getting colder and colder. Winter's coming.
I got two daughters that live on the Isle of Wight.
Oh, really?
Yeah, okay. And I've been over there a few times freezing my butt off in January or Christmas. Hell yeah.
Yeah, it reminds you you're alive, doesn't it? You feel all your senses working.
Yeah. So anyway, you're a physicist, according to our friend Liz Hazelton, our mutual friend, who's our publisher or your actual editor, I guess. So where did you go to school at? What's your background in physics?
Well, I did a first degree in physics at university, so I did my bachelor's degree in physics at the University of Sussex, which is in the south of England, and I stayed on there to do a PhD. It's an experimental PhD, so I wasn't hot on the theory, so I was cooling superconducting metals down to 0.3 Kelvin, just above absolute zero, and watching their strange quantum behavior.
Oh, great! Because I'm also a physicist, but I only had like an MA in it. But superconductors has been one of my favorite areas for a long, long time, especially with the SQUID project back in IBM in New York years ago.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. In the Josephine Junction, and I developed.
That's right. That's what I was working on.
Really?
Yeah, yeah.
So tell me about that.
And SQUID.
Yeah, let's talk about that for a second.
Okay.
So anyway, what were you doing specifically with SQUID work and Josephine Junction?
Well, basically, I was looking at how you can get the quantum behavior, so you get things in two different quantum states at once. When you cool these things down and kind of isolate them from everything else. So they're known as macroscopic quantum circuits. You know, they're big in that the niobium superconductor I was using was kind of like, you know, probably about a centimeter across. And it was a quantum object. It literally, you know, could be in two different states at once, meaning that the currents, for instance, the electrical currents could circulate around it clockwise and anti-clockwise at the same time. And, you know,
you there? Hello?
Okay. So I was looking at these macroscopic quantum objects, which are rings of superconducting metal with this little point contact in between that kind of squeezed into quantum state. And we would watch currents going clockwise and anti-clockwise around at the same time, you know, in this macroscopic quantum superposition. So it really was like, you know, having Schrodinger's cat there.
It's like looking at a superstring almost, huh?
Well, I wish we could do that. That would be amazing.
Yeah. But when you start describing clockwise and counterclockwise fields, that's immediately what pops up into my head is the very foundation of matter itself, you know?
Well, this is it. I mean, this is the whole thing about quantum theory is that, you know, it's our most fundamental theory. It throws up so many surprises. And the amazing thing, though, is that if you kind of corner quantum physicists on this, they'll say, well, most of them will say, well, they don't think they've got the ultimate theory yet. You know, they haven't, you know, quantum theory is somewhere near the truth, but not the absolute truth. So, you know, we've still got discoveries to make down there. But the fantastic thing is that when we discovered quantum theory, you know, we got all these strange kind of spooky behaviors that just made no sense at all. And so, you know, maybe if we get this next theory, the even deeper theory, maybe there'll be even more strange and spooky things that you know, we might discover.
Yeah. What were you guys, when you guys were doing this work, you know, I mean, you know, in quantum now we talk about, you know, like, you know, Einstein calls it a spooky action, but, you know, the thing about teleportation, you know, changing the polarization of one photon when going one direction and one photon going the other, when you only mess with one, the other one automatically changes.
Yeah.
I think that, to me, this is my field. You know, I mean, if I ever went back in as a professor or teacher or a student or whatever, I went back, quantum is the area that I like to work in. Quantum entanglement, especially, you know.
I absolutely agree with you.
Yeah, were you doing much entangling stuff with?
I wasn't doing any, but it has kind of been a bit of an obsession of mine ever since then.
Yeah.
And lots of the stuff that I wrote for New Scientist and continues to write for New Scientist kind of looks at this. You know, this is one of those strange things, you know. No wonder Einstein just said it was spooky, because it really is spooky. And, you know, there's something going on there that just tells us something really deep and fundamental about reality. But we haven't yet kind of figured out what it is saying, really. So experiments are just continuing with entanglement. And of course, you know, people are trying to put it to use to build a quantum computer and, you know, kind of, you know, make this ultimate computing machine. And I just think it's such a fascinating field, you know, and we're no further on in our understanding of it, really, than we, you know, than Einstein and Bohr were all the time, you know, when they were debating it. You know, it's kind of just defies common sense.
Yeah, no, I agree. And what's his name? The guy that died in 1991, he was writing on the holographic effect of it. Bohm, David Bohm, remember him?
David Bohm, yeah.
Yeah, I read some of his books, and I was fascinated by him, you know, saying, well, you know, it's an illusion. Nothing exists anyway. You know,
it's just an
interference of light patterns and energy patterns, you know?
Well, you know, I mean, there's still people who subscribe to that. You know, it's certainly not been ruled out.
Yeah.
And the whole thing about the history of quantum theory, you know, it's full of all these people who have these crazy ideas, and you know, none of them have yet been, I think somebody once said, no, your idea is crazy, but is it crazy enough to be right? You know, it's like there's no holds barred when it comes to explaining quantum phenomena.
Yeah, I agree. I agree. So you're going to continue in the field, obviously, right?
Well, I'm continuing to write about it and kind of, you know, keep an eye on research papers that are going on. You know, my interest for New Scientist has to be broader than just entanglement. I think our readers would go mad if I produced, you know, endless streams of these things. But I can't help just being fascinated by the whole thing. You know, I think it's one of those things that somehow speaks to human beings in some ways. You know, we like the idea that there are these kind of spooky connections across the universe. So you know, it's just endlessly fascinating for me.
Well, you know, like I told Liz the other day when I read, when she first sent me your book, I started into it, you know, and I could see right away it was written from a quantum point of view.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I mean, that's how I saw it, because I've been doing the quantum stuff since I was a kid, and I couldn't put it down. You know, to be honest with you,
that's great.
I really, literally couldn't put it down. It's got a bit of an intellectual twist to it, but I think if the common man, the regular guy out there on the street, takes the time to read it, I think it really does open up a lot of questions.
It certainly does that, yeah. I'm really glad it's so accessible, though. You know, there's a lot of topics in there, and a lot of them are, you know, they're not straightforward things to understand. So, you know, it's great to hear that you know it is accessible.
And I see you started it out. You know, your starting point was the Hotel Metropole in Brussels, which I've actually been to, and Solvay Physics Conference. That's where you started out with this book, huh?
Yeah. That's an amazing
experience. What was
happening
at that conference? It was really exciting. Anything much? I mean, some famous arguments have taken place there between Einstein and some of the other guys. I know that much, but what was going on when you were there that year? Do you go every year or what?
No, that was the only time I've been.
Yeah.
And it's one of those things where, you know, I mean, it only happens every few years. I mean, they don't do it every year.
Yeah.
And it's one of those things that it's just got this kind of air of history about it when you're there. You know, every year they take a photograph of all the delegates to the conference, and you know, and this kind of tradition stretches back to the times when Einstein and Bohr were there. And you know, you can see on the web, you can find like pictures, you know, where Marie Curie is there, you know, sort of standing next to Einstein. And you just think this is an amazing kind of history to this conference.
Yeah.
And when I was there, they were discussing the whole problem of dark energy and what to do about the fact that, you know, the universe is accelerating for, you know, for a reason that nobody can understand. And there were a bunch of string theorists there just kind of pulling their hair out metaphorically. And lots of them don't have any left anyway. But, you know, it was really kind of a difficult atmosphere. You know, people were really stuck.
Yeah.
And so that, I mean, that's kind of what, you know, what kind of prompted me to start on the book, really, that sense that, you know, there are these things out there. And unless you're on the inside, and unless you can get to go to a conference like this, which I'm, you know, lucky enough to be able to do, then you just don't realize how science is, you know, it's full of these stops and starts. And you know, it has these frustrations which can sometimes go on for decades. You know, and this is, you know, I think the Solvay conference particularly has this history of just kind of trying to tackle the problems that you know, just seem absolutely insurmountable.
Yeah. No, I agree with that. Was Leonard Susskind at that one, or does he go to those? I talk to him every once in a while out here at Stanford, but I just wondered if he was at that one. I know you mentioned him.
No, I'm pretty sure he wasn't at that one, actually. I'm trying to recall. There were a lot of great people there. That Gerard Hooft was there, and Murray Gell-Mann was there. There was about six or seven Nobel Prize winners in all. It was just Frank Wilczek was there. Just a massive kind of agglomeration of brilliant minds, you know. And
it's a lot of fun around those guys, huh?
Yeah, yeah. It's pretty crazy, just kind of, you know, walking down the stairs or, you know, getting in the lift with, you know, with people like this. And they are extraordinary people. And, you know, I've no wish to kind of denigrate them in any sense. You know, I think physics has made some extraordinary breakthroughs in the last 100 years. And many of the people that are still alive, you know, have been responsible for those. What's really interesting to me is the fact that, you know, you will still come across things that you can't explain. And, you know, and maybe you have to wait for the next generation to come up again.
Yeah, no, I agree. I'm kind of watching the activity over at the Large Hadron Collider over at CERN right now.
Yeah.
And then
you're watching the inactivity
the
at the moment.
I've been watching that, you know.
Yeah.
So there's a lot going on out there.
Well, there is. But, of course, you know, it's getting bigger and bigger, these experiments, aren't they? I mean, they're just... You know, they're so colossal, and you know, so they're all sort of 30 years in the planning. The Large Hadron Collider was that long. I think the gravity wave observatories were at least that long, you know, and physics is pretty, you know, it's at a stage where it's got to do some pretty hefty experiments to make progress now.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, one thing, have you worked much in gravity waves? I'm sort of a student of it, but...
No, I haven't worked an awful lot in gravity waves. You know, I kind of know the basics, but
yeah, that would be like the 14th thing to put in your book. You know, the reason I say that is what's fascinating about gravity waves, from my observation, is that theoretically, if a large one came, you know, and let's say and just hit England only, your complete time structure would completely be different than the rest of the world by a massive amount. You'd completely go
into it. Yeah, it's incredible, isn't it?
Yeah, that is some cool stuff, you know?
Well, you know, I mean, we already work on different time zones, but the idea that, you know, somehow there'll be a kind of real discontinuity in the way time moves, you know, it just, I think it's another thing that's just beyond our understanding in some ways.
Yeah.
I mean, relativity itself, you know, the idea that time is this kind of thing that stretches and, you know, contracts. It's just, you know, it's just so weird to think of it, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. But I think that if we don't already have it, you know, in the black ops department over at Area 51 or some of these other places, I think we're touching, when we start playing around with and letting things out with gravity waves and the squid work that you did, and I think we're approaching some kind of a propulsion system that could be pretty phenomenal in spaceships. I really think that we're not too far away from that, or if we don't already have it somewhere already, you know?
Well, you know, I mean, these things we'll never know for sure. It seems to me, you know, we really understand very little about gravity itself. You know, when you think that it's this force that affects all of us, you know, every single day, you know, we live with it, and physicists literally can't really explain, you know, where it comes from, or, you know, what the point of, you know, of mass is, you know, where mass comes from. You know, I think that's extraordinary. You know, gravity is probably the biggest mystery of all in some respects.
Yeah,
but, you know, crack that one and you've got anti-gravity, haven't you?
Yeah, exactly. You know, I've always felt, and I think that someday that consciousness, I'm sure you've heard this one before, will find a way into physics. Simply because energy follows thought, just maybe from that metaphor only, I think it'll someday find its way. You know, I don't know how it'll work mathematically yet, but you know, I relate to gravity like in a relationship. Like when I first started talking to you, I feel a warm feeling coming from you. Whereas some people I'll have on this show, I don't feel comfortable with at all, but I have them on because that's what I do, you know. But
yeah,
I feel a common bond right away, and to me, that's an effect of gravity. And yeah, so I've kind of looked at it that way. Now I want to go into your first chapter,
okay,
Missing Universe, which we touched on basically, the missing universe, the uncertainty principle, which most is we're familiar with. The missing universe, all about, you know, dark energy. You know, it's energy that, what did we say, the universe is 94% missing energy? I mean, you probably know the exact numbers, but, you know, we're not really here. We're only here by 6%.
Yeah, we basically mislaid 96% of the universe.
Right.
In that, you know, we have a, which sounds ridiculous, I know, but it's true. You know, we have an idea of how much mass and energy there is in the whole universe, and we can only account for 4% of it. And when physicists do the sort of measurements and astronomers kind of work out what's out there, you know, they reckon that about 25%, a quarter of the mass and energy in the universe is made up of this stuff called dark matter. Now that makes it sound like they know what dark matter is, but they haven't got a clue. Literally no, people have been looking for dark matter and talking about it for more than 60 years now. And nobody really knows what it is. You know, the idea is that there's some particles, that can't be seen because they don't reflect light. You know, they don't interact by any force except gravity. But most astronomers are pretty convinced that 25% of the universe is this stuff that we have no concept of. And then, the rest of it, apart from the 4%, is this dark energy, you know, which is effectively ripping space-time apart. You know, the universe is expanding ever faster, so its expansion is accelerating. And there's no kind of force that can account for that at all in the kind of lexicon of physics, if you like. And so physicists have just come up with this label of dark energy. You know, there's this dark energy that's ripping apart the universe. But they haven't got a clue what it is any more than they know what dark matter is.
Yeah,
so literally,
now,
we're down to
4%. When you start looking at mass and you start looking at the Higgs field, the Higgs boson.
Yeah.
Would you think in theory that if the Higgs boson is proven, the Higgs field is proven to be in existence that gives us mass, that it might be somewhere in this cosmic battery that we would call dark matter that would give us mass or not? What's your feeling along those lines?
I'm not an expert on the intricacies of the Higgs mechanism, but as far as I understand, you know, people are fairly confident that they understand where our mass comes from, where the mass of normal matter comes from.
Yeah.
And they think if they find the Higgs boson at the Large Hadron Collider, that will kind of confirm all the theories. But that won't actually tell us the exact root of mass. It'll kind of give us an indication that we're on the right track, but it won't tell us what really gives mass. And I don't think it will speak a great deal to what dark matter is. One of the things they're hoping to discover at the Large Hadron Collider is some kinds of particles. They're just hoping that in their collisions, they'll see something come out which could be a dark matter particle, something that interacts only via gravity. And that's kind of the best hope they have, is that, you know, they'll just smash this stuff together and, you know, all kinds of oddments will fly out of it, and maybe one of those will be the dark matter particle. But how it relates to the Higgs field and stuff, I'm not really sure, and I don't think anybody really knows.
I don't know. I'm way out in the left field on that one, but I just know that. That's why I'm asking you. What's your confusion factor with this? You know.
Well, I mean, it's pretty high because I think we've been sold the Higgs as the answer to mass, but I think when you look at the details of it, you know, there are still a lot of unanswered questions, even if we discover the Higgs. So. But, you know, we're really going to have to wait and see what comes out of this Large Hadron Collider, because, you know, there are various things that are expected and predicted, but, you know, it's more likely that the unexpected will come out of it, which is very exciting.
I love the fear of the ignorant society types that said when we first turn this puppy on, it's going to create black holes, mini black holes, and destroy the Earth.
Yeah.
Remember that one? That was a pretty good one.
That was it was pretty good. It was pretty ridiculous on many levels as well, because of course when they turned it on, you know, they weren't doing any collisions, so there wasn't going to be a chance of creating a black hole.
Yeah.
And I think that was lost on sort of 99% of the media. You know, they were kind of waiting with bated breath for the world to end, you know, without, you know, making reference to the fact that nobody was going to collide anything, you know, when it first turned on. So, you know, there wasn't going to be no black holes. But the whole thing was, you know, to be honest, a bit of a sort of media frenzy, wasn't it? They picked up on something they could report.
Yeah.
Which,
you know, even in California, out here in the United States, they take the weather and try to make that into a catastrophe. I mean, they have a very negative look about anything anymore in the media, because there's, you know, I'd like to see more positive coverage. Now, I completely agree
with you. I think there is a case for just kind of, I mean, the problem we've got is these sort of 24-hour rolling news channels with nothing to say. And, you know, and so they have to kind of create these compelling disaster scenarios in order to get people to pay any attention to them.
Yeah.
But it seems to be spinning out of control, doesn't it? You know, because actually, you know, there's a lot of interesting stuff that never gets reported because it doesn't kind of fit this template of, oh my God, you know, we're all going to die kind of thing. So
yeah, that's a death wish.
Yeah, I think it is something like that.
You know, I'll give you, on the subject of nuclear accelerators and that, I started out at the University of Michigan back in the 50s as a kid in high school and then college. Uh-huh. My dad went to the University of Michigan. He brought the London Bridge over, by the way, and put it in Havasu City. That was my dad that did that. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. They it was called Site 6, and then they made us a bunch of condominiums and became Havasu City, so they made some money on it eventually, but it was real interesting because there was no water in the Lake Havasu at the time. It was still dry. They were just building a dam. But anyway, at the University of Michigan, I studied under what was called Operation Paperclip scientist, Dr. Katz. He was worked with the Third Reich. And we had a...
Oh, right.
Yeah, that paperclips where they brought, you know, scientists over from in different, you know, different Nazi-type personalities to work over here.
Yeah.
You know, on a peaceful level. So anyway, I'm working with him. And we had a cyclotron, a synchrotron, and a bevrotron, and a linear accelerator underground, of course. And my big thing was watching the acceleration of neutrons into calcium and observed on a Wilson cloud chamber. That's what we had in those days, you know?
Yeah.
And just for the people out there, that there would be little specks that... that you would see, and that would, you know, represent some kind of a temporary particle, because the speck would kind of show up and then go away. I know on the Large Hadron Collider, I saw pictures of the detector on that puppy, and it's the size of a high-rise building almost.
They're crazily big, aren't they?
Yeah, and I guess that some of the, you know, they'll look for the same specks on a much greater level, and I guess some of the things that they don't see will confirm possibly some of the particles that do exist only for a second or two, or a millionth of a second, or a billionth of a second. So I just wanted to throw that in. Then, I'm just going through this. I'm going to go through your book a little at a time, you know.
Yeah.
And I think we've kind of covered dark energy as much as we can. And... Well, the next area that's one thing I wanted to say, though, in dark energy, you know, in relationship to the universe speeding up, you know, the large heavenly bodies leaving, you know, going away from each other at an accelerated rate.
Yeah.
I feel that quantumly, that's why we experience here on Earth, time seems to speed up. I mean, when I was a kid... Especially when I was doing, you know, delivering papers at 4 o'clock in the morning, freezing my butt off. Now, it seemed like that 4 to 5 o'clock on a bicycle took a long time. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But in today's time, it would just be a few minutes.
That's a kind of noticed phenomenon, isn't it? As we get older, it seems that time passes much, much faster. But of course, our perception of time is a weird thing in our brains, because if you think that, you know, an astronaut traveling on a space rocket actually has time kind of speed up.
Yeah.
And you know, relative to sort of back on Earth, or slow down rather. So, you know, you sort of think, well, how does their perception of time work? You know, do they perceive any difference? You know, obviously we're talking, you know, with the speeds our rockets can go, not a huge amount of difference. But, you know, would that astronaut have any perception of time in any different way from people back on Earth? And, you know, we have no idea how the mind kind of interprets time. And, of course, you know, we don't really have a good notion of what time is either. You know, the physicists are still arguing about that. And really have no clue really what it means. And some of them say time is just an illusion and doesn't really exist anyway. So, you know, we've got all kinds of odd things going on with time.
Yeah, but when you look at a hologram, then there is no time. There's an interference, and we're measuring.
Well, that's right. And I think, you know, and in fact, I was talking to somebody a few weeks ago who is looking at, you know, getting David Bohm's ideas. You know, we talked about this guy who kind of, you know, basically thinks that you know, the deeper reality is some kind of hologram. And I think this has probably quite a lot of bearing on our notion of what time is. When you're measuring the universe and measuring, you know, the acceleration of the universe, you know, we've got all kinds of factors in there, like, you know, the issue of time, because obviously if you're measuring speed and acceleration, then you've got to have a concept of time. And, you know, because we haven't got a good concept of time, we're making leaps in the dark in many respects. You know, we kind of think we're seeing, you know, dark energy. We think we're seeing this accelerated expansion. But there are many possibilities that you know, lie outside of that kind of normal reference frame. And our understanding of what space-time is as well, you know, this kind of fabric of the universe, is really not very strong. And, you know, it may be that we've kind of completely made, you know, assumptions, invalid assumptions about the nature of space and time, you know, that will make this dark energy go away once we understand these things. So, you know, I think all bets are off in some ways. A lot of money's going into sort of working out what dark energy actually is. But, you know, I wouldn't be that surprised if we find out in sort of 40 years' time that the whole thing was some kind of optical illusion.
No, I agree. And one of the things that I've studied a lot and talked about is the precession of the equinox as we rotate around the Pleiades, our central, you know, star. And we rotate around that about every 26,800 and some odd years, and metaphysics or astrology has divided that into ages, you know, 2,250-year period.
Yeah.
And what I have noticed is that looking back in history, not quite as far back as, you know, the Big Bang, but looking back in history, the civilizations rise and fall. Atlantis. Lemuria, our civilizations. I think I'm working on a book now about that. I start my book out with the advance of science with a guy named Thales back about 500 BC, and then I come forward forward in my little book that I'm writing about the personalities. I'm going to put you in there, by the way.
Yeah.
Now that I've talked to you, and I look at the consciousness interacting into the hologram of the specific intelligence capability of the DNA structure in the body, and especially the brain. And it seems that in this cycle, there are periods where our brains and our logic and all of that seem to work at a much higher frequency than they do, let's say, back in the time of Thales, you know, 500 years before Christ, that time. And I made that observation. And then I start to see it becomes like an exponential curve, starting probably about the time Einstein was born, maybe just a little bit before him. And when we get all these super geniuses start popping up, so I'm wondering, you know, it's kind of interesting to see logarithmically how quick and where we end up in the next decade, for example. You know what
well,
I mean?
Yeah, it's interesting because I think, you know, science certainly changed, you know, with Einstein, and it's not just because of Einstein himself and his brain, but because the world, I think, in the last century has got so much smaller in terms of communication and the way, you know, the way we're able to kind of chat across the Atlantic Ocean now. You know, we've changed the world fundamentally with our technologies, and I think, you know, that's accelerating too, and who knows what we'll be able to do. You know, so hopefully, you know, we are accelerating in our understanding of the natural world and the universe. But you know, what's astonishing is that, you know, when you actually probe it, although we are kind of making enormous progress. We're also, you know, really quite sort of fundamentally stuck by a number of things.
Yeah, I agree. Now, the next thing that is in your book that was real interesting is about the two Pioneer spacecraft.
Yeah.
Go ahead, and I'll let you explain. You can synopsis that chapter quicker.
Okay.
I didn't even know this was going on. Their time difference.
Oh, really? Oh, that's great to hear. Because I mean, you know, this is something that started effectively the story begins at the end of the 60s. You know,
yeah.
When they're trying to put men on the moon, and at the same time, NASA had these other missions planned, including these two Pioneer probe missions, which are going to go and kind of, you know, go out into the solar system and do some measurements and do some science. You know, they're scientific instruments. So, you know, in the background, while, you know, the whole Apollo thing is going on and everybody's very excited about the manned space flight, you know, NASA was kind of continuing its efforts to kind of, you know, make measurements and cosmological measurements using space probes. So it came up with these two probes called the Pioneer probes, Pioneer 1 and Pioneer 2, which launched in the early 70s in the end. This is in the era of kind of punch card technology, you know, for computers.
Right,
you know,
the old Fortran fairy tales, I used to call that, with a punch
card. You know, and this is, you know, before, you know, Bill Gates has left college to form Microsoft or anything like this.
Yeah,
we are in really kind of rudimentary computing territory. So these probes go off into the solar system, and the guy who's running the missions, a guy called John D. Anderson, starts to notice after a few years that they're drifting off course. And, you know, this is, you know, coming from the data that these two craft are beaming back. And the hilarious thing in some ways is that he didn't tell anybody because he was kind of worried that they just got their programming wrong. And so these things are going off course. He's looking at his data, trying to figure it out, scratching his head and saying, you know, I can't for the life of me work out what could possibly be pulling these things off course, whether it's our programming for the trajectories or something else. And he sits on this for 10 years, and then eventually starts telling people about it, and word gets out. And various people step in and say, oh, you know, they've missed out some part of relativity, or, you know, there's some easy explanation for this. And basically, since the end of the 1970s, nobody has ever been able to explain this anomaly. You know, these craft who are being pulled towards the sun at a rate that's kind of not—it's not a huge pull at all. It's just a very slight thing. But you know, NASA has worked these trajectories out, you know, to the, you know, incredibly accurate degree, and they cannot, for the life of them, find, you know, a reason why these two craft, which are, and their trajectories are going wrong in exactly the same way. They've just never been able to figure it out. And you know, this remains, you know, known as the Pioneer anomaly. And, you know, some of the world's best brains have kind of gone to work on this, and we still don't have a good answer. So, you know, it's a really, really fascinating puzzle, because it could be that it's something really mundane, like, you know, heat leaking out of the spacecraft. It would have to be that.
Leak out of both of them at the same rate, though, right?
Exactly. It would have to be an identical fault or failure in both craft. Or at the other extreme, you know, you could say, well, maybe there's some kind of force out there in the cosmos that we didn't really know about. You know, and you kind of have to, you know, pay your money and take your choice. So, you know, where do you want to go with this? Because the evidence is still coming in. We still don't have a good idea of the right answer.
Well,
and
you know,
everything's up for grabs.
Yeah. Speaking of that now, I have a sidekick named Steve Barish that's on my show. He's not obviously on today because we're recording this, but
yeah.
He and I have been doing a little thing on Planet X.
Oh, yeah.
And the anomalies that, if it in fact did exist, supposedly NASA sent up some infrared satellites, and there's an infrared base down there in Antarctica now. Supposedly
yeah.
To study this phenomenon of this planet, but we don't even know. We're not sure if it even exists. And then
so this would be out beyond the Kuiper Belt.
Huh?
This would be out sort of at the Kuiper Cliff, the edge of the Kuiper Belt.
Yeah, it's supposed to have like a 3,600-year orbit, you know, kind of an
okay.
orbit around our sun. What do you think is around this strangeness in the solar system? What do you feel about that? I mean, have you studied?
Well, you know, I just think it's entirely plausible because, You know, have you seen the the best pictures that we have of Pluto, for instance?
I've seen pictures. I don't know if they're the best ones or not. Yeah.
Well, they probably are the best because I think we've got very little. We just don't know what's out there at the edge of the solar system. And there is this thing called the Kuiper Cliff. So in the Kuiper Belt, you've got all these kind of rocks, asteroids sort of circling around. And then all of a sudden, that just drops off. And it doesn't just fizzle out, but it literally drops. You know, the 1 minute there's loads of these rocks, and the next minute there's none as you travel out of the solar system. And I know there's a guy called Alan Stern, who's at the Southwest Research Institute, I think in Boulder, Colorado, who's a very well-respected astrophysicist, who is absolutely convinced there's a planet out there, Planet X,
wow.
That we've yet to discover.
Yeah, I've heard
and
his name before,
what he thinks is that it swept up all this debris.
Interesting. Where is he located? Up in Colorado? Is that where he's at?
I think he's in Colorado. I'm sort of coming from memory. Alan Stern, his name is. And, I'm pretty sure it's the Southwest Research Institute, it's called.
Okay.
So, and I think, he's got a very good point. And when you look at what's out there, and how little we actually know. I think it would be really surprising if there wasn't something out there in some respects that had just swept this area clean, and kind of all the debris had agglomerated into, a new planet that's out there that we just haven't yet seen,
Yeah.
And, I think, it probably takes quite a lot of number crunching to work out the orbits and how it would affect the orbits of the other planets. But, I think it's an investigation worth pursuing, isn't it?
Yeah.
I guess it would still be just a lump of ice and rock like Pluto, but interesting nonetheless.
Yeah, and the other thing that's interesting is the lack of solar flares that we've had recently.
Yeah, isn't it?
Have you looked into that at all?
Well, I mean, I've kind of done a little bit on it. I mean, I think people aren't too worried, but we know so little really about the cycles of the sun. We've got sort of various probes looking at the sun, and we know that it has this 11-year sunspot cycle.
Right.
Nobody's ever seen such a quiet period, I think, for a very, very long time. And who knows? I mean, the sun's a bit of a mystery. It's got this magnetosphere that, it kind of shoots out all the plasma jets, and it just seems like, we don't really have a good idea for why it would suddenly go so quiet. So let's hope it's not the kind of calm before the storm.
Yeah. Well, right now, I think with the stock market and the world markets being manipulated by the governments for control of the populace, maybe we need sunspots again to get the...
It would be terribly bad luck if we unleashed the solar storm of the century now as well, wouldn't it, with everything else that's going on?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's definitely, when they say the civilization ends as we know it around 2012, I'd say that we're well on the way.
Oh, that's a scary thought, but they like to scare us, don't they?
Yeah, that's every time, I know I studied fascism, Marxism, Nazi, all that stuff. It's the same program. It's the same program. The big banks come in and they take control. They bankrupt the people. And then, of course, the people that we bailed out in this country, as you know, almost $1 trillion worth of bailout, they just put that in foreign, the Japanese and different foreign investors got that money back, didn't do anything for the American public other than make it worse.
No, that's right. I mean, the whole thing. I mean, economics has become this black box as well, where if you look at the models for economics, none of them actually make any sense. And there's a whole bunch of physicists who are saying, look, we've analyzed economics and what the so-called science of economics, and really it's been found wanting. There's a lot of behavior that happens in the markets that shouldn't happen according to the economists' best models. But of course, their best models are just a rough guess. And it seems to be, it's one of these complex systems that, that has these unpredictable dynamics. And
yeah,
somebody needs to take account of that, really.
What I'd like to do is to, in your third chapter, I'd like to drop alpha right into the stock market. Did you ever think about that one? I mean,
well, it's interesting, isn't it? Because, this idea that the laws of physics aren't constant, as we've been led to believe.
Yeah.
This idea that we've seen variations in this constant called alpha, which controls an awful lot of processes in the universe. And the idea that we've got this kind of, set in stone idea of what physics is and what the laws of physics are. you know, it's an absolute outrage to most physicists, the idea that, you know, one of these things might just change or have been different in the past, because it means that all the way, you know, all our working out of the history of the universe actually could be wrong. If, you know, if everything's allowed to change, then you can't sort of just wind the current laws back to time zero and expect everything to work. So it throws a lot of things into question. And it is a bit like economics, really, isn't it? Because everyone's kind of suspected that you know, maybe the markets are kind of not quite what we thought they were. But you know, nobody's expected that of physics. So yeah, it would be very scary if physics turned out to be more like economics than we thought.
Yeah, that seems like where it's going.
it's just terrifying. I don't want to scare people anymore.
Yeah. So anyway, in your chapter, varying constants, I that was one I just loved, it because you hit on a lot of areas that I personally have studied. Emission of light from the star. Richard Feynman's QED. Feynman. He was a real piece of work. I guess he did most of that in a bar up in Pasadena, you know, with strippers.
And, while playing the bongos, no doubt, as well.
Yeah.
He was an extraordinary man.
Did you ever meet him or anything?
I didn't. No, I didn't. I wish I had. I have some friends who did meet him.
Oh, wow.
And he was, I mean, apparently incredibly personable. You know, he was not aloof. You know, he was not distant. And as a friend of mine who writes for New Scientist called Marcus Chown, and he actually studied under Feynman for a while. And at one point, Marcus said to Feynman something about Marcus's mother is a great fan of Richard Feynman. And Richard Feynman turned to Marcus and said, "Well, tell your mother something." He said, "Tell your mother that love is much more important than physics." And apparently when Marcus kind of, you know, reported this back, I think she pretty much swooned at the whole prospect of Richard Feynman addressing this to her. So
I think he was an extraordinary man,
you know, and I think we miss people like that in science, in physics.
Yeah, he was like Elvis was to rock and roll in my book. Yeah, I got his book. I got it from England. It cost me $300, about 150 pounds. I got a copy of all his artwork that I guess his last wife, widow of him, put together.
Yeah.
Quite an artist. Well, he was good.
Yeah, he was just an amazing individual. And you know, and he enabled people to really connect with science. And I think one of the problems that we have now is that there's almost nobody out there who's really enabling people to connect with science. And, you know, and he was humble about science as well. You know, you mentioned QED, this theory, quantum electrodynamics, that he came up with and won a Nobel Prize for. But, you know, he was quite humble about that theory, and he said, you know, there's still lots of problems with it. And he even used the phrase hocus pocus about it. You know, he said, some of these numbers in this theory, we just have to pull out of thin air. You know, which I think is not the kind of thing you hear from physicists today. You know, you don't hear that kind of sense of, you know, we're a long way along the road, but we're not there yet. What you hear so often is, oh, you know, we've solved the entire history of the universe, or, you know, we know how everything works. You know, and it's just not true.
That's right. Yeah. I've been around some pretty arrogant physicists in my time, and I just kind of laugh. I mean, there's nothing, you know, to me, the unknown is the unknown, and I think when we don't have the unknown, we won't exist anymore, you know?
That's right. I think we're a long, long way from kind of working everything out.
Yeah. Yeah, and I like, of course, Einstein's thing about God doesn't have a blueprint, and it's just interesting all the comments. Well, the next chapter, which was chapter 4, rang home to me because this is back at the University of Michigan. One of the things that I did get to watch, I didn't really work on it because I was pretty young, was cold fusion, the pinch effect.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah. Now that is a really good one, the cold fusion.
It's one of those topics that basically people told me to avoid. You know, my colleagues and various sort of physicists that I know sort of, they just turn their nose up at the whole discussion of cold fusion. And just to give some background, it's this idea that you can have nuclear reactions that happen at room temperature, where you don't have all the drama of a huge explosion and a mushroom cloud, but you can still release energy. But you can release it in a much more controlled way. And the idea is complete anathema to physicists because, you know, everything they're taught says that nuclear energy can only be released from inside the nucleus, you know, by smashing it apart at incredibly high energies. But what if they're wrong? And you know, we literally don't have the answer to this. And we have these tantalizing results from 1989 and since that seem to show that there, you know, there is something to this idea, that we haven't yet mastered the technology of doing it. But, you know, something around this, you know, seems to be able to release nuclear energy. And I think the evidence is pretty incontrovertible now that actually we have something nuclear going on, even if we haven't yet sort of ascertained properly whether there's heat released or, you know, whether there's energy released that we can use. You know, I think it's pretty tough these days to argue that there isn't some kind of nuclear process going on in these things. And that's very exciting. You know, it's just a shame that we've had, 20 years of it just being ridiculed and thrown out. You know, I think we've missed a big opportunity there.
Yeah, I think so. I my feeling with cold fusion has been there's got to be some form of resonance that gets through heat. I don't know what kind of formula that would be, but some resonating frequency, whether it be a modulated or a constant wave or whatever, possibly could set set up a I don't know if you'd call it a destruction, but a definitely change in elemental structure of an element, therefore producing energy. But at the same time, it might be like a weapon that would do that. You know, you start.
Well, I mean, that's right. I mean, I think the thing is, you know, with the atomic bombs and everything, you know, the familiar ways that we have of releasing nuclear energy, they're like a sledgehammer and a nut, aren't they? You know, they're not subtle. They're not gentle. They're just, you know, the brute force kind of approach. And what nobody really knows for sure is whether there's another way to do it, and whether there is, you know, whether there is a way to kind of find a resonance or some kind of characteristic of the nucleus that you can exploit to kind of just unlock it. You know, maybe there's a key that, you know, you almost turn the lock and the thing springs open.
Yeah.
And this is what, you know, many people have wanted to work on and not been able to do because, you know, it's been such a, you know, a no-go field for physicists.
Yeah, I know. And, some people that worked on it get highly embarrassed because they don't get results. I was reading.
Well, that's right. I mean, the trouble is, it's a classic field that you know, it's hard and nobody really understands it. And the original guys who started the whole fiasco, Martin Fleischmann and Stanley Pons, you know, they were trying to understand the theory behind the nucleus. They weren't trying to create, you know, free energy and kind of make themselves millionaires. And you know, the whole thing went so horribly wrong because it was badly handled from a sort of press point of view. But actually, the science is still wide open. And, you know, there are various people who've kind of lost their careers through, you know, really insisting that we look at this rather than brush it under the carpet. And one of them is a Nobel Prize winner, Julian Schwinger, who actually, you know, he was enormously respected as a theorist until he started sort of asking questions about cold fusion. And then he was kind of just isolated, ostracized, and people started talking about how, you know, he'd gone all wrong. And, you know, all he wanted to know was, well, you know, how do you explain these results?
Yeah. Now, I have a question. Now, you talk about the plastic, the C-39 chips.
Yeah.
Could you explain a little bit about, you know, them and the Navy and that? Because you've got it in here.
Yeah, yeah.
I thought that quite fascinating. It was news to me, by the way.
And
I read that.
Oh, right, yeah. I mean, it was when I discovered it, and I've kind of been following this for quite a number of years now. I guess it was about 2003 or so when I first kind of came across this. But the U.S. Naval Research Labs have been researching cold fusion pretty much ever since the whole thing broke in 1989. And they've been doing it so quietly. Just a few of the researchers who were interested, who actually worked with Martin Fleischmann before all this sort of blew up. And so they knew he wasn't a nutcase. You know, they knew he was a respected scientist. He was a fellow of the Royal Society. You know, he was in the in crowd, as it were.
Yeah.
And so they started doing it very quietly, using, you know, very small amounts of money, using their spare time, and just following this through. And for about 15 years, you know, they've been getting good results on and off, and interesting results. And, you know, sometimes they get heat in their equipment that they don't know where it comes from, but so far it's not been reproducible. So, you know, it's kind of just had to stay as a kind of anomaly. But one of the innovations that they made recently in the last couple of years was to use things called CR39 chips, which are basically pieces of plastic. It's the same kind of plastic that you use in spectacles, in your eyeglasses. And what happens is when you put these somewhere near a nuclear reaction or radioactivity, they get marked with tracks, rather like the kind of particle detectors that are used in nuclear physics. And so you kind of get this kind of array of tracks and rings and pits in the plastic from all the particles that are being given off by the radioactivity. So if you put one of these chips next to a piece of depleted uranium, for instance, you get a certain kind of pattern which shows up the kind of radioactivity that depleted uranium gives off. Now, what they found was when they put these CR39 chips into their cold fusion chambers, into their experiments in which they were trying to kind of understand whether there were nuclear reactions here releasing energy, they got exactly the same patterns in their chips. And so, the evidence was pretty incontrovertible that they had nuclear reactions going on.
Yeah.
When they showed these to kind of nuclear experts, they couldn't tell the difference between, the depleted uranium chips and the chips from the cold fusion labs. And that was published, I think, last year. In a very respectable journal. It had to be a German journal called Nature Wissenschaften, which Einstein used to publish in, funnily enough. But because none of the mainstream journals, the kind of UK and US journals, will even look at the results, any results associated with cold fusion. So, they've kind of had the playing field, set against them from the start. But this was a huge breakthrough, in my opinion. This showed that there really was something going on.
Yeah, no, I'm fascinated by it. As I can see it, you're pretty much. How are you approaching physics now? Kind of as a. I know we're all students, but I mean, you seem to be getting into all different corners of it. Is that what you?
I do. It's one of those things that you're kind of. I feel like I kind of wandered down the rabbit hole, and I'm just going all over the place and just discovering these things that have lain dormant for so long or not been talked about for so long. And, it's almost like a kid in a candy shop or something. Everywhere you turn, there's something that just absolutely fascinates you.
Yeah.
And this cold fusion thing, I went to Washington where they were presenting their results to the Navy, the few naval researchers working on cold fusion stuff. And I met them all and we talked and I just thought they were absolutely top-class scientists in that they weren't really interested in, they didn't see this as commercial potential at all. They were just fascinated by what was going on, and they had these experiments and these results they couldn't explain. When I put it to them that maybe, if they've got something that works, maybe they should build a prototype of, fusion reactor. And they just kind of have never entertained the idea that this was about producing energy. They just wanted to understand, nuclear processes. And I think, this is what I'm discovering, is there's a kind of a quiet strata of scientists who are just fascinated for the sake of their interest in science. And that's great to discover that they're still there, because, of course, so much of the time what we hear is, the person who shouts loudest about their own work, the physicist who is so good at publicity and promotion that actually, the quality of their work doesn't really matter. It's whether they can get the attention of the media. So it's really interesting that there are these people kind of working quietly behind the scenes and producing some really fascinating results that you don't normally come across.
Yeah, no, I agree. I like I say, I've been in the cold fusion for a long time, but I've never really had a chance to work. I've just been an observer like you, I guess.
Yeah. And the trouble is that the information that you get is always tainted by, the prejudice. There are very few journalists who are willing to come out and say, actually, I think there's something going on in here. And so what you hear all the time is the kind of denigration of the whole idea, which is a real shame, I think.
Yeah. Now, we're running up to the top of the first hour of our recording here.
Okay.
And so I'm going to re-announce the show again. And then reintroduce you, and so that we can start into the second show, because we've pretty much covered the first one.
Okay.
time goes pretty fast around here.
Doesn't it?
Yeah. So do you want to take a break or anything, or are you okay?
I'm okay, actually, yeah.
Okay. Hold on one second. I'm just going to grab a glass of water. I'll be right back.
Sure. Okay.
Yeah, one second.